Welcome to the Changemakers Podcast, brought to you by City Current and powered by Lipscomb and Pitts Insurance. This show shares personal stories and insight from those who are giving back and making a difference so we can learn and do the same. We cover life lessons, business advice, passion, and purpose. Now here's our host, Jeremy Park.
Welcome to the Changemakers Podcast. I'm your host, Jeremy Park. We are in for a treat when you talk about job creation, innovation, social entrepreneurialism. We are here with a changemaker indeed. We have Carla Javits. She is the president and CEO of the Roberts Enterprise Development Fund, REDF. Carla, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's wonderful to be here.
Absolutely. So let's start. The fun of this Changemakers Podcast is we get to learn a lot about what you're doing with your organization, but we also have a little bit of your personal story woven into this as well. So let's start with the personal story and how you got into this, and then we'll talk a lot about REDF and the work that you're doing. So let's start. I know that you're a grad. UC Berkeley is a part of your storyline, but give us a little bit of idea of just where you personally grew up and a little bit about your childhood.
Yeah, well, I had a somewhat unusual childhood. I grew up in New York City, one brother, one sister. We lived in Manhattan in the 50s, 60s, 70s. And, you know, toward the back end of that, the city fell on pretty hard times. And I certainly saw poverty all around me up close and personal. I say unusual because my father was an elected official. He was in Congress, Attorney General, U.S. Senator for all the time I was growing up for decades. My mother was deeply involved with the arts, mental health issues. She entertained. She loved bringing together people from all different kind of communities, the arts, politics, science, business. She was sort of known for that. And I think that might have something to do with my lifelong interest in bringing people together across different disciplines.
Sure. And you yourself are really passionate about the arts as well. So there's a lot of neat parallels there.
Yes, so true. Yeah, we were lucky enough to get to both see, you know, a lot of visual arts, but also go to the theater, which I love dearly, and music, always been a huge part of my life. And, you know, both of them, though, had grown up in very poor families. Like, you know, my father's mother, sort of classic story, sold dishes from a push cart down on the Lower East Side. You know, my parents taught us the country had treated us well, and really our fundamental charge was to give back, you know, very much of the theme of this show, I think.
Right.
And, you know, they also gave us a feeling, I have to say, that things could be changed, that we could be change agents if we put our minds and our backs into it. I mean, they didn't start, you know, with much in the way of, you know, financial well-being or connections or anything else. And they've, you know, they've had a huge influence. So, you know, they kind of gave you that spark that you can do things, you can accomplish things. And, you know, they valued education, but also work. Kind of interesting from that time, neither one of them had a college degree, although my father did get a law degree, which you could do in those days at night from NYU. You know, they lived very active lives. They were really enmeshed in the community. You know, he called his autobiography the autobiography of a public man, and that sort of sums him up. And I think, you know, they would have loved the theme of this show and the work you're doing.
Well, and I think it's, you know, when you grow up in that environment, one, you get to see many different sides, but two is you probably met a lot of interesting people and had some, you know, interesting traditions. What's maybe one tradition on your end that stands out just, you know, from a family perspective?
You know, I think probably just that we did talk a lot of current events. You know, we talked about what was happening. I mean, it's kind of interesting today when you hear about politicians, most of what you hear about is, you know, the raising money, the, you know, the mean campaigns, the, you know, the politics of it. And I do not remember a single conversation at home about that. It was really all about what was happening in the world and how should we do something about it to make things better, whether it was war and peace or poverty or civil rights or whatever it was. That's what we talked about at night. And in fact, my kids tease me because they used to say at dinner when they were growing up, we'd have the radio show because I was all, you know, I was always interested in these issues and wanting to talk about them. So I don't know. I think I just grew up feeling like we were very much part of the society we lived in, and we needed to be agents of change, and figuring that out was kind of the core of life. And I still believe that. I still feel that. And I think that's really been the inspiration, certainly for the work I've been so lucky to do.
So growing up in New York, but then you go to UC Berkeley and you get your BA and your master's in public policy. So what led you to go all the way across over to UC Berkeley?
Yeah, that was actually a little lengthier story than that, which I'll make brief. But I stopped off in the Midwest, went to the University of Michigan for a minute, and then stopped going to school, worked for a bit there with a group that ran a bookstore and a newspaper, a kind of current events newspaper, and then came out to California to go to UC Berkeley. A friend was coming out, so I came along. And then I left school again for a while, and I ended up getting an AA degree in hotel and restaurant management, working in the restaurant business, which I loved and enjoyed. But then, you know, as I was, you know, standing on my feet at 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, doing prep cooking and working all weekend and holidays, I thought, well, if I'm going to work this hard, kind of back to my roots, I want to have some impact on the bigger issues that I care so much about. I was still an activist, but I was not, you know, not doing that professionally. So I ended up going back, getting a BA, and then I got a master's in public policy. Worked for the state for a while, for the legislative analyst on kind of looking at poverty issues all over the state of California. Learned a whole lot about how people don't agree about how to solve these problems. And, you know, we got to find ways to bring people together to really create solutions. And then I came down, I worked for the city of San Francisco. I was lucky enough to work for a great person named Julia Lopez, who was really a mentor to me. That was right when, sadly, homelessness, crack cocaine, and the AIDS epidemic were sort of exploding in the cities. And so we were hit with that front and center. She ran the Human Services Agency, and I was supporting her work there. And then that led to a long stint doing work around housing for homeless people with a wonderful group called the Corporation for Supportive Housing, and then on to Red F.
That's good. I mean, I think many times people forget, it's one of those where you see you in your current role, but you don't understand all the experience that led up to that opportunity to create bigger change. And many times, you know, when you talk about change makers, there is an evolution. It's like there's no overnight success, but there's a long evolution of learning, of sowing, you know, those seeds and those relationships that then lead to the opportunity to create bigger change. And so, you know, you got to walk before you run. And I think many times you see somebody kind of out there running and creating big change, but they forget that it's taken a wealth of time and experience and relationship building to be able to get to that point so that you can magnify your ability to create change. Talk about maybe one kind of lesson that you learned, you know, in those sort of capacities that then you've been able to parlay and use in your current role with Roberts Enterprise Development Fund.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the big lesson for me from all the years of work is honestly that it is possible to create change if you have a good idea and the evidence that it works, that is central. You have to start with that, not the PR, but the reality of something that actually works. And then you have to, you know, you have to engage people in understanding why they can do what they want to do. They can accomplish their own objectives by working with you to further, you know, to further that, whatever that is.
Right.
And that it really requires people working together. If you look over history at anything that has really improved life for people, it fully engaged the business community, the government, philanthropy, people themselves, from whatever community is affected in working together to create change. And I think still, what we have a lot of, unfortunately, is people who tend to run only in their own lane, and really they speak a different language from one another and do very little to try to understand and translate what they're doing so others can understand it and get on board with it. But I think the magic happens when you can do that, and I've certainly seen that.
Well, it definitely echoes the things that we're, you know, doing and learning here in Memphis. And I think we talk about all the time here is that while money is a great resource, and obviously nonprofits and so many organizations rely on money to fuel that fire, a dollar bill doesn't physically solve any problems. Put a dollar bill on a table, it doesn't shake anybody's hand, doesn't come up with any solutions. People do. And so when you talk right. about people, you know, coming together, to your point, breaking down those silos, communicating, but realizing, wait a second, the only way we're going to create real change, the only way we're going to solve these problems is to be physically engaged. People physically solve the problems. And so to your point, the more that we can knock down those silos and get people to understand, wait a second, we do have the ability to come together, especially in times of peace, and learn from each other, build those relationships so that when conflict arises, we understand, wait a second, we're not enemies. We're all on the same page. We need to fix these problems and come together and look for solutions. I think that's monumentally right. important.
So true.
Well, let's go ahead and tell listeners. So the Roberts Enterprise Development Fund, one of the big things, you know, that you guys are known for, it's the only philanthropy in the world that invests exclusively in employment focused social enterprise businesses. And when you talk about social entrepreneurialism, you know, I look at it in the lens of you are investing in companies that have kind of a for-profit mentality, but the whole goal of them is to be able to kind of have an apprenticeship type mentality and program where they can train those who are homeless, who need help, who needs opportunities, but to give them the real world skills in a real world environment that's serving as kind of a for-profit mentality. But the idea is that they get to then go through that program, holistic wraparound services, succeed, and then kind of matriculate into other opportunities. And then you bring kind of that next wave in. So you're always creating and always training our citizens. And so I think it's a really amazing model of what you're doing. But obviously that's my version. So you tell us, when someone says, what do? Describe REDF.
You know, I'm always excited to hear somebody else tell the story because I feel like we're starting to, you know, penetrate this approach, you know, if others begin to understand it, can explain it. So that was a great description. But to paint you a quick picture of how it works, you know, so REDF provides money and business know-how to these employment-focused social enterprises. So they can grow and they can be sustainable businesses that create, as you said, jobs for people who would otherwise be shut out of the workforce. And then the enterprises themselves hire people who want to work, but because of their backgrounds, employers really are not likely to hire them, and they might not be quite ready for prime time. You know, it could be young people who have had little work experience in their lives, or, you know, even in their families or in their neighborhoods. They might have run into really hard times, been incarcerated, or even, you know, homeless. And, you know, these businesses that we call employment social enterprises, as you said, they provide not just a job with a paycheck and the experience kind of skill building employers are looking for, but they also provide support like help with, you know, housing or health issues, childcare, money management, whatever it may be that the individual needs to get them ready to succeed in the regular workforce. Things that perhaps, you know, we got from family and friends, but, you know, they weren't able to get.
Right.
And then on the business side, you know, these are real world businesses that make money. They, you know, they take their profits, they pour it back into helping the employees. The customers get great products and services. The companies make money. And, you know, most importantly, the employees, you know, start turning their lives around. So that's really the heart of it. You know, in terms of REDF, you know, what do we do try to help with this? Well, to some extent, you know, we're the heart of the work is we're like, it's kind of like a venture capital firm. We provide some of the capital that's needed to grow the business, and we pair that up with the top-notch advisory services like, You know, we might help them develop a plan for a new line of business or assess the market so they're pricing their products or services competitively. And on the people side, you know, we might help them understand the effect that, you know, traumatic life experiences, which unfortunately a lot of these folks have had, violence and other things, you know, how do you effectively manage and coach staff who might have that kind of background? And so that's kind of the heart of the work. And then we also are building a network of these organizations so they can help one another and, you know, teach one another. And then we, of course, measure the results and feed that back to improve performance and also to try to convince the powers that be that this is worth investing in.
Well, before we talk about the numbers, because you have impressive impact numbers, I want to kind of touch on a couple things that you said along that way. One is that the power of the peer-to-peer learning, the power of you being able to benchmark and share best practices across the board. So when you look at a local level, a regional level, and even at a national level, saying these are some of the things that are working in other communities with other businesses, let's shorten those learning curves so that you as this entity can one, make the most impact possible, but two, have the shortest learning curve so that you can get up on your feet and be sustainable very quickly. And I think that ability to share and kind of network together, the network becomes so powerful because you're learning across not just communities, but across different disciplines and best practices. The other thing is, I think, you know, for listeners to understand, and we've talked about it on our end before, is the sustainability of this. So when you look at nonprofits having to kind of rely on contributions from individuals, foundations, to be able to keep the doors open and fulfill their mission, having a for-profit model where you, to your point, are providing a goods, providing products, goods, and services that people want and that are helping them with their business and their life, well, now this for-profit side that's providing a good and a product that you're buying supports this nonprofit mission, so to speak. It's much more sustainable. So now we're not waiting until the end of the year to see if there's any money left that we can give. No, literally everything is baked in so that with every single transaction, there's a higher purpose. If you're buying this good, you know you're helping these individuals in your community with jobs and job skills and helping to turn their lives around, which in your point, all of a sudden, next thing you know, they're paying taxes, they become productive citizens, they're homeowners, they're buying cars, all the way around, we win as a community. And I think that's important to understand.
Yeah, I think there's, you know, there are so many wins here. You know, it's kind of a win-win-win situation. Right. Just on your first point, I just wanted to mention in terms of sharing, we've put up a website that's separate from our sort of, you know, redf.org. It's called redfworkshop.org, one word, redfworkshop. And you'll see right on there a very cool interactive map where right away you can kind of click on your own community and see, you know, what are the social enterprises nearby, or, you know, is there a particular line of business you're interested in food or
love that,
you know, recycling or whatever it might be. So, and a lot of lessons learned and the ability to talk to others. So, you know, I really urge people to check that out. And yeah. And then, you know, in terms of kind of that win-win, I thought I might offer an example.
That's kind of where I was going next with. You know, you've worked with over 100 social enterprises, you know, just in California. So go ahead and share some stories, and then we'll talk about the impact you're having overall.
Yeah, I thought this was kind of a neat story. Here's an example of a business near and dear to my heart that's called the Women's Bean Project out of Denver. So they make bean soups and rubs, cornbread, cookie mixes. And a new line of popcorn I was enjoying last night that comes nice. All packaged up and ready to go with very tasty seasonings. So they employ women who struggled with homelessness or incarceration or other tough issues. And, you know, just an example of a person, let's call her Lisa, someone who had recently worked there. You know, really tough life. This woman had been, true story, she had been born to a mother who had been addicted to heroin. She herself used drugs at age 10 because she was physically abused and, you know, just an awful life. She eventually demonstrated some kind of incredible grit, got sober, came to work at the Women's Bean Project, where, you know, she got a job and some support to deal with the issues of her past. And she's now working at Coors Tech in Golden as a quality control inspector, earning a good salary with benefits.
Nice.
And there are a lot of stories like that that also involve children. And, you know, obviously often, you know, people have children, maybe at a young age, maybe those kids are even taken away because their lives are chaotic. So the reunification with the children and then the demonstration that, you know, they can have a good life and there's a role model for them, help them with their education. I think this is really about sort of the multi-generational impact.
Absolutely.
You know, it can have for one person to, you know, to get a job. And then, I think Women's Bean is such a neat example, too, of how exciting it's been for us to get to partner with organizations like this. This is an incredible organization run by a tremendous leader named Tamara Ryan. You know, very skilled, and they're doing a great job, but they wanted to grow and expand and do new things. And with, you know, a relatively modest investments of resources and, you know, kind of advisory service, we came together and they worked on repackaging all of their products. And I just had a chance to see Tamara, and she said it's just gone wild since they repackaged, you know, for a lot of stores that were carrying them, but maybe weren't featuring them as prominently or spreading them to multiple sites. All of a sudden it unlocked a lot of doors, you know, just as it does for any business,
right,
to think about doing some things differently. So that's just a great example of the kind of work we've been able to do together that I think has really unlocked both the business potential and then obviously the potential of the people who actually work for the company.
And I like the fact that you look at it from that generational perspective. I think that's really important, once again, to understand is, you know, by helping a parent not only have a job, but, you know, even to your point before about just the value of education, of wanting to go off and maybe finish college or get your degree, well, all of a sudden now that becomes the priority for your children. And they get to see, wait a second, okay, this is what it means to have a job, to have a college education. And so that becomes the expectation then for them. And to your point, it completely changes the next generation and then generations on. And I think that's how real change becomes more permanent, more sustainable, and obviously that kind of ripple effect for all of us in the community. It's important to understand the bigger picture of everything you're doing. Talk about, you know, impact overall. I love the fact that you said before you keep track of everything, you measure everything. I think for nonprofits especially, that's a great lesson to learn, is that especially when you talk about funding, is, you know, there needs to be measurable results. And you've had that, more than $327 million in revenue, over 21,000 people. When you talk about the companies that you're working with and just the employability and the people that you've helped, 21,000 already, those are big numbers.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we've really made a practice. You know, we were founded by George Roberts, who's co-chairman of KKR, big private equity firm. And from the very beginning, you know, as a man who's, you know, involved in investing in the business community would do, he's really focused on results and, you know, let's know what results we're trying. It's kind of a simple equation, but, you know, it's hard sometimes, I think, in the press of issues that nonprofits are struggling with, to spend the time to figure out what results are we really trying to achieve? Are we getting there? Can we measure enough to know? And then most importantly, have that data so that we can feed it back to the people who are doing the work at the front line, so that they can improve and learn how to actually have the impact that they, you know, that they're trying to have. And then, of course, you know, trying to bring that data to, you know, to investors, to the public sector, to philanthropy, so that they too can see, you know, look, we're using our money well. This is the goal we're trying to achieve, and you're actually achieving it. So that we've spent a lot of our resources and energy doing that with the groups we work with, and I think, you know, it's been a great positive effect. We've all learned a lot from it. And, you know, some of the things we've learned, for example, are that about 80% overall of the costs across all the groups that we've worked with can be covered by earned revenue. For nonprofits, that is staggering.
That's huge, yeah.
You know, sometimes people come to us and say, well, you know, are these quote unquote profitable businesses? Well, some of them are. Some of them are, you know, at 110% or 120%, and they're able to, you know, throw off some revenue for the support services and other things. But, you know, even if they're covering their business costs, 80% of their costs, you know, essentially what that means is we don't have to tap philanthropy or government. We don't have to have the uncertainty of that, you know, or use up those precious resources. You know, these are business models that really are providing that skill building and training, you know, based on a lot of this revenue that they're bringing in. So, and kind of from that, we had a third party company named Mathematica, a very reputable firm, look at what we call social return on investment. And what we found is that for every dollar that a social enterprise spends, we get $2.23 in return. Why? Wow. Because people who are working use less in government benefits, they're more self-sufficient. And then the program, of course, costs less than most social programs because of the earned revenue.
Right.
So, it's really a win-win-win. And, you know, and the people employed, their incomes go up by like 268%. You know, we've compared them to people who get traditional workforce services and found they're much more likely to be working a full year later. You know, so a lot of really, really positive results. I think the one thing I just wanted to mention on the learning side, you know, that we continue to focus on and try to bear down on is we want to make sure that over time people have a chance, if they're able, to start building their skills and make more money over time.
Right.
You know, our focus is primarily on that entry, solid entry into the workforce, you know, hoping then that people can get a foothold and move on. But, you know, we're trying to pay more attention, and the social enterprises are, to building the kind of skills that allow people really over time to move up, you know, and have the kind of wages and benefits that that allow for a good life.
I know your eye is on the ball, obviously, with what you do, but I've got to believe there's an inspirational piece of this for other just, you know, for-profits across the board. So when you look at the ability to not just focus on profit, but purpose, using every business as a chance to leverage opportunities to bring those who need, you know, a second chance, need an opportunity, whatever it is, to invest in, even if it's one or two jobs, but opening up a pipeline for even veterans to come in and use your business as a catalyst. I've got to believe, you know, just seeing what you're doing across the board has to be an inspiration for every business, so to speak, to say, wait a second, we can rethink the way that we view profit to be able to make a difference, not only in our generosity on the corporate philanthropy side, but literally using our workforce as an opportunity to create change as well. Is there any kind of carryover that you've seen or that, you know, to me, like I just look at this as an inspirational opportunity for everyone to learn from?
Absolutely. That is so true. And I think, you know, it's on a number of different dimensions. I mean, first of all, look, even beyond the social purpose idea, I just was at a big gathering the Federal Reserve Banks had on the topic of workforce development. And I have never heard the business community as concerned as they are right now about accessing talent at every level of their business, you know, from the front line up. You know, unfortunately, we have a big drug epidemic in this country. Unfortunately, we have a huge number of people who have a prison record now. We have a lot of homelessness, and companies are, I think, at the verge of seeing that, you know, they're going to have to start thinking about how to tap talent from some of these other communities and open their doors in a different way, you know, in order just to get the people that they need. And I think social enterprise is such a neat puzzle piece because it serves, if you will, kind of as that farm team or, you know, place that they can sort of de-risk the hire because, you know, people have a real job and can kind of prove their chops on the job in a social enterprise and then move on into mainstream employment. So there's kind of a core issue there. And I think companies can get involved in two different ways. One is procurement. You know, just including some of these groups in the supply chain makes a huge difference. And, you know, I would cite There are companies even like Whole Foods, and Amazon, which have now gone through their merger.
Right.
Whole Foods has been buying in a number of different markets around the country, both food products and even some of the shelving, that they used to do display in the New England area. They were buying from a great social enterprise there called UTech. Whole Foods buys a lot in a lot of different markets. So procurement makes a big difference. We're all familiar with kind of hiring from minority and women-owned businesses, which is so important. But this is like a different business model, employment social enterprise, that companies can lean into as part of their supply chain. There's even an incentive that's in the law in Los Angeles, for example, for companies like this. So I think, hopefully we'll see more of that. And then around hiring, absolutely. We need companies, and we see them, both small businesses, medium, larger companies, that are willing to take a look at the requirements that they've set and really make a judgment about whether, the hurdles, barriers they've set up make sense,
right,
given the skills and attributes they're looking for. And, the social enterprises are just great partners for that, because they're real businesses that, are kind of giving a tryout job to folks. And that's really helpful for the companies.
That's great, great advice. When you look at, kind of on the advice front, offering advice for someone that says, especially right now with the millennials coming out and their entrepreneurialism, but two is their desire to make a difference, to use their day to be impactful. What advice would you give someone that says, I want to launch a business, but I want to launch a social enterprise. I want to use my powers for good. How do I start? Where would you start guiding someone who wants to walk on that path?
Yeah, wonderful question. And we do see a lot of young people who are really interested in this area and getting involved. In fact, we have a new accelerator program we're really excited about for entrepreneurs that are, have more nascent businesses that are on that growth path. But I think, the two critical questions that I would ask if I was in that position are, what is it I want to achieve on the mission side, on the social mission side? What is my objective? And then on the business side, is there a market that I can penetrate for the product or service I'm thinking about putting out? And do those two things dovetail? Because one thing we learned the hard way here is that sometimes there's, on a nonprofit, there's a board member or there's a staff member, and they say, hey, I have a great idea for a business. And they, and I have a little, space over here I can use for the shop, whatever it may be. But then it turns out the capital expenses are really high. They wanted to employ a lot of people, but this particular kind of business only employs a couple people. And it's a really hard market to penetrate. There's too much competition, and that's where these things founder, on the shoals of, is there a market for the products and services? And am I clear about the social mission, I'm trying to achieve? We do, on that Rediff workshop platform, there's a great tool section, and we've tried to kind of pour in everything we've learned from all the hard lessons and the successes of the companies all over the country there. So you can actually walk step by step through your own business planning idea. And I've done that with, using it for ideas I've come up with. And it's super helpful. So I think those are the two things I think about.
Love it. So one more question, then we'll just kind of do what we call a lightning round, which are just quick questions and fun answers. But what's next for Rediff? I mean, obviously you're expanding, as I mentioned, nationally, you're really reaching out and doing bigger and better things. What's on the horizon when you look at stepping into 2018 and beyond? What are some of your focal points?
Yeah, well, I think this work and the impact is especially important right now. We're 1 year, from the so-called forgotten American election. And unfortunately, we still have millions of people who are able and willing to work, but are locked out of the workforce for a variety of reasons. This solution isn't partisan. It's something, Democrats and Republicans can get behind. Everybody wants to see people working. And so we've set our sights on 50,000 people employed by our community of social enterprises by the year 2020. And, you know, honestly, beyond that, we'd like to see this really go deep in multiple places around the country where you see a lot of support. You know, you see this sort of enmeshed in the fabric of those communities and people understanding how important it is to have more social enterprises and more of these individuals employed. And frankly, get on board with the notion that we have a lot of talent sitting out on the sidelines that could be working, could be involved, but we have to, you know, and we know how to do that, but we have to make an investment in order to, you know, to get there. So that's our big objective, 50,000 people employed by 2020. And then from there on, you know, we'd really like to see this kind of take off and go to a different scale so we can begin to be part of the solution for the millions of people who, you know, who could be working and contributing to their communities and the future of their children, but right now just can't find that pathway in.
And once again, I think the ripple effect is important to understand. When you give someone a job, it does, it changes their family, the generations. There's also the ripple effect of improved workforce development, improved discretionary income, which leads to more companies and products and goods and services, but it also reduces crime. I mean, there's so many things that all go along with by focusing, laser focusing on job creation and opportunities. It carries this ripple effect within every community where, you know, the whole community is lifted. So I think it's, you know, once again, important to understand context, but by laser focusing on one area, there is a ripple effect that genuinely creates that win-win-win for all of us. So let's go ahead and transfer over it. We call it lightning round. There's no like special, you know, music or things yet, but it's really simple. I just ask some fun questions and then you give kind of short, fun answers. So the first one is, you know, what's a recent book you've read?
You know, I'm right in the middle of a great book by Arlie Hochschild, and sadly I keep forgetting the name of it, but she goes down to Louisiana and talks with a lot of the people who, you know, who voted for President Trump and who are very discouraged with kind of what's happening with our government, and she talks to them seriously about you know, kind of why they feel the way they do. And it's incredibly insightful. So I highly recommend it. Try to look it up while we do the rest of the lightning round. Give me a name.
The fun of being able to access
not
Google.
Good at the names always.
What's a favorite TV show or something that you enjoy watching?
Oh, gee. I maybe a little shallow. I like sports.
Hey, that's a good thing. I'm with you on that one. Do you have a favorite team? Because, I mean, obviously you've been coast to coast. So do you have favorite teams you support?
Yes, I love the Oakland A's. I've been an A's fan for a long, long time. It's been a hard year for the A's. And, of course, I love the Warriors. I'm a good Bay Area gal. But, yeah, I have a fondness for baseball because both my kids played softball and baseball. So I've been watching the World Series, which has been hot, hot, hot this year. So I'm really enjoying that. And the book, I just wanted to get you the name, is Strangers in Their Own Land, Anger and Mourning in America. It's really, really good. Highly recommend it.
All right. So what's a favorite vacation spot?
Oh, yeah. You know, I love the Southwest. This year we went with my kids to Colorado and Santa Fe, New Mexico. Just spectacular. Gorgeous.
Little different weather there than you'd find in the San Francisco or the Bay Area or New York, huh?
Yeah, it's that nice dry heat, which I really love.
What do you like to do to relax?
You know, as I kind of said earlier, I grew up so much with art and theater and music. That's really my favorite. Go to a show. Go to hear, go to a concert or just listen to music. I like to walk and listen to music and hang out with the family, friends. I love to cook. I'm a big cook.
What's your favorite meal to cook then? Do you have a favorite, like a go-to? If you have people coming over to the house, what's your go-to meal to cook?
Yeah, I can make a mean roasted chicken, roasted potatoes, veggies. Simple, but really good.
Hey, we'll take it. All right. So give us a favorite quote or something. It can be from, you know, just an inspirational quote or a quote maybe from your parents. But what's a favorite quote that you still think about or remember to this day?
Well, you know, it's sort of, we almost call it like the official quote for Red F, but it means a lot to me. George Roberts, our founder, said, if you don't have a job, you don't have hope. And if you don't have hope, what do you really have? And I just think that summarizes at a deeper level the whole, you know, the whole meaning and purpose of the work we do here.
So, you know, obviously you're creating your legacy every single day, you know, both individually, personally, with your family, with Red F. What, you know, when you look at maybe 20 years from now, what do you hope that people say about you and the work that you've done, especially with Red F?
That we really showed that people who were long considered kind of people who were never going to be able to participate in a positive way in our society can do that, should do that, and there's a way to make that happen, and that's happening in every place in the United States, because frankly, this issue that people who can work, want to be part of our society, want to be positive and contributing, can't find a path in. And I think I'd like us to be looked at as having created that path in a way that every community, has now baked that in to the norms of what they have to do, must do, and deliver to their citizens.
Nice. Well, the last question is the easy one is, where would you direct listeners to learn more about Red F, which once again is the Roberts Enterprise Development Fund. So where would you direct them to learn more about Red F? And then, you know, obviously to perhaps follow you, I know you're on Twitter, but where would you direct everyone to learn more and to follow the conversation?
Yeah, please join us at redf.org is our main website. You can learn about our portfolio and lots of the good work, conversation that's going on. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we have a redfworkshop.org platform that's really for practitioners, to form a network with one another and learn more about the details of how to do this important work.
Well, Carla, greatly appreciate you coming on the Changemakers podcast. You are a changemaker. You're doing amazing things with yourself, your family, your organization, and we can't thank you enough. So greatly appreciate you coming on the show and sharing all the amazing lessons learned and the good deeds. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was a joy to be with you. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to the Changemakers podcast, produced by City Current and powered by Lipscomb and Pitts Insurance. To learn more about our guests and to share your stories of others leading by example, visit us online at citycurrent.com. Connect with us online using @citycurrent or follow the conversation using the hashtag changemakers. Now, think big, start small, and act now. Be a changemaker.